Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 270, featuring Esther Estevarañola, who I have known for a long time. He was, you know, he was working on visual effects when I first started in visual effects. He is now the Senior Vice President of Creative Production at Skydance Animation, which is a pretty serious role, right, Kristen?
Very big.
Yeah, yeah, he's pretty cool. And he was at Pixar for a long time before that. So it's pretty interesting background that Estrus has, and it was pretty cool. What did you think of the podcast, Kristen?
Well, I learned about shampositing or shampoo that he yeah. and Chris Harvey at DD came up with. So shader compositing. Yes. That was an interesting story.
I'm glad you think so. It's a pretty techie story for you to pick up on. And by the way, I should note that there are actually two Chris Harveys, not to get confused with each other. There's a Chris Harvey who's actually at Pixar. No, actually, no, he's at DreamWorks now, I believe. But there's a Chris Harvey who's a much more TD software developer. And then there's another Chris Harvey who is the main visual effects supervisor for Neil Blomkamp. Two different Chris Harveys, but two very bright people at the same time. So not to get confused. It's kind of like the two Chris Nichols situation, remember?
Oh, yeah.
it was really cool to talk to Estrus about that kind of stuff. What were some of the other things that you liked about the podcast, Kristen?
His role at Pixar was awesome. He worked on really cool movies like Ratatouille, Up, Cars 2, which are huge. Mm-hmm. And then he explains how Pixar uses its short films kind of as guinea pigs for new technology. And that was
right.
That was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a really cool thing. I think it's a pretty cool that people are able to learn a little bit about that. The other thing that was interesting was we should also note that this was the last podcast that I recorded in person since isolation. So this one was actually done in the studio when, you know, just before they basically said that, hey, we need to shut down everything. So this was the last one I was able to do, unfortunately. But we've been doing a lot of remote podcasts, and we've recorded a whole bunch from home. And Kristen has been amazing at booking some really great speakers. So there's going to be a lot of good podcasts coming up. So look forward to that. Yeah. Any other announcements we have to make, Kristen?
Not right now.
Not right now. We have obviously things are a bit in flux, but I definitely go check out our page, chaosgroup.com, because we will have some announcements coming up. Hopefully you guys are all being safe and at home. And if you guys, need to relax and think about other things, there's a ton of library of CG Garage podcasts that you guys can listen to. So check those out for sure. And if you want to know more about the podcast, where can you go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcasts or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys want to have ideas for other podcasts or any comments, please let us know. labs@chaosgroup.com is our email. And remember that we are now actually, because we are in isolation, I am no longer obligated, not saying that I only have to do them in person. So if you have any ideas of anyone around the world, or if you want to be on, let us know. Just send us an email. That's again, labs@chaosgroup.com. That being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with my good friend, Estrus Varagnola.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You know who I had on the podcast not long ago? I think his episode just came out. Alex Nishma.
Oh, Alex, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
It's funny. So he and I were just talking about how, like, our first film that we ever did, like our first movie we ever did, was we started almost on the same day at DD on Day After Tomorrow.
I remember that, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the first time I worked with you, right?
Yeah, that was, I think so, yeah.
You were doing
the lighting lead.
Lighting role. Lead on the buildings and...
Yeah, the city and, you know, like the New York...
Right.
Destruction part, I guess, you know, like lighting to that and working with compositing. And you guys were helping out a lot with the, obviously, the set modeling and...
Right.
And, you know, like the frozen version of...
Yep.
The city and all that good stuff. Yeah.
It was a, honestly speaking, and that show was obviously met with challenges, and my audience has heard many stories about those challenges. But I really thought it was through those challenges, we became a pretty tight and fun group to work with, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, I remember, you know, like, because we basically transitioned to the next couple of shows after that.
And right,
like,
right.
iRobot
and Stealth. Yep.
So it was a good primer.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. But so one of the things that people like to hear is, and sometimes the opportunity I get is that even though I've known people for years and years, I don't actually know their origin stories. And on podcasts, I get to find out about it. And so a lot of people who may know you will have that opportunity as well. So what is your origin story as a young man growing up in Venezuela?
So, you know, like I basically was born and raised in Venezuela. I lived there until I was in my early 20s and studied architecture there.
Oh, you were an architect too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So like every other person in the industry, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
And then I relocated to the California, really, to try and pursue a career in traditional animation, hand-drawn animation.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to do any computer graphics whatsoever. All I wanted to do was just draw and animate traditionally. Mm-hmm. But when I got here, basically, that industry was just, you know, dying. You know, like, it was, I think, 1996, and a couple of flops from Disney had just happened, and Toy Story had just come out, and, well...
93.
Bug's Life, actually, because Toy Story was like 94, but you know, like the next one was a Bug's Life or something like that, and you know, like that traditional animation was kind of going away, and then 3D was kind of taking over. So I kind of switched gears and started looking into you know, pursuing a career in you know, CG and what that. And
but you didn't have any exposure to much computer graphics at that
no,
time.
No, none whatsoever. And so I basically got my first gig was at a company called Vision Art.
Oh, right.
Down in Santa Monica. Uh-huh. And, you know, like.
How did you get that gig?
Well, a friend of mine was a compositor there. Uh-huh. And she was like, hey, you know, we're looking for PAs, basically.
Right. Yeah.
And I was like, totally, I'm there. I'll go there and then I'll do the errands and whatever. And in the meantime, if you have a workstation that I can use, you know, to learn the stuff, that could be great. And they were like totally cool about that. And that place had a lot of peaks and valleys, right? When we're in full production, there was, you know, obviously a full house full of Indigo stations and, you know, like all of the SCI's boxes, right, at the time. And, so, but when I started, you know, they were basically pretty light at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot of open stations to kind of sit down and kind of learn.
And what were they doing mainly? Commercial work or?
Well, initially they were doing a lot of commercial work and then some TV stuff like Deep Space Nine.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So like a lot of that work came out of there. And, you know, like some of the Talking Animals films, a lot of spillover work from Rhythm and Hughes.
Okay.
Godzilla, you know, like that was one of the big ones. And then, you know, like just, you know, like traditional compositing work, you know, and some with some effects. But then, you know, like that company folded and I, you know, like we went out of business. And then, you know, a friend of mine, Aladino Debert.
Oh, yeah, Aladino.
Aladino moved over to Digital Domain. He was like, hey, man, we need help over here.
And this was around
2001. So my first day was actually September 11th.
Oh, wow.
2001 over at Digital Domain.
Oof.
So obviously I couldn't start that day.
right.
And the sequence that I was supposed to start on was one of a meteorized shower destroying buildings. so that got caught.
yeah.
So it was an interesting time. And I got to meet a lot of great people on that show.
What show was that?
It was the Time Machine.
Oh, Time Machine. That's yeah. right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I got to work with great people. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, Didi was a great place to kind of come in and definitely learn from a lot of like super experienced people. But at the same time, everyone's very open with knowledge and sharing things. And there was definitely a feeling of, you know, everyone's trying. It was all about the work, but at the same time, have fun while doing it, right?
Right.
It's very intense, long hours. It's definitely a young man's game at the mm-hmm. time. Emphasis in a lot of male.
Very male.
Energy.
Yes.
At the studio.
I think when we were in the digital building at that time, I think there were two women in the entire building that were working there.
So, yeah, in our group, like, definitely really, really small presence, which has definitely changed over the years.
Oh, yeah.
And when I moved over to from Digital Domain to Pixar, I actually got to see a much balanced representation on both sides.
Right.
Right? Like, so, you know, like, Didi was definitely very, you know, like old school, early CG, computer graphics stuff. Yep. And obviously that company has evolved a lot. But at the time, it was just very, you know, there were no real schools teaching this stuff, you
right.
know. So, you know, you kind of had to sit down and put a lot of time and effort on your own to kind of, you know, keep up with things.
Right. But it was still a good environment for learning and a good opportunity for people like you and me to basically grow pretty quickly. They gave you opportunities to jump into lead positions very, very easily. If they saw potential in you and they saw that you could do something, they gave that to you pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, like, I mean, all the shows were very intense in nature, right? Mm-hmm. So you get to test the metal. Mm-hmm. Really, you get to test, you get to see what people are made out of, you mm-hmm. know, and how they react on like very stressful situations. And for the most part, everyone kept their cool and were able to kind of like make things work and just like roll with the punches in a
sure.
good way, right? So yep. I think that, you know, they kind of got to see what certain folks were all about pretty quickly, right? You know, there were some politics like in sure. any other place, but, you know, not as established, like, say, a bigger, you know, infrastructure and, you know, like a
right.
1,200 people shop or something like that.
Right? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I've
been
yeah.
there for a long time. There's a lot of legacy and all that.
Yeah. Stuff. I mean, I know, like, for example, Sony, when I was there, was much more of a traditional, you know, company corporation, right? So you had to sort of step the ladder up to get to where you need to be. It
yeah.
wasn't like throw you in the fire and see if you survive. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, no. I mean, there was the turnover was high at Didi, obviously.
Yeah.
So, and you know, they didn't have a big staff, right? So they
right.
kept a core group of people that they felt, okay, we could keep those people around and we know if we get a show, we're going to be able to survive with these folks and then ramp up when the time is right. And
right.
that's the model they have for a long time. And
sure.
I believe they still have to some
yeah,
extent.
Yeah, to some extent, yeah. But it was – so. But curious though, because you got onto Time Machine, but did you go into lighting for Time Machine or what was your
– No, it was basically my job for that one show was to work in a 1,000-frame shot.
The big time-lapse.
The big time-lapse. So it was basically modeling the city,
right.
doing a lot of modeling and some shading work and and working with Andy Weisler, who
mm-hmm.
was the lead for that shot, and then
Eric Nash, I believe, was the soup.
Eric Nash was the soup, and you know, like just basically that was like my intro to the show. And then after that, was like immediately got picked up to go and work on Nemesis,
yes.
Star Trek Nemesis,
yep.
right? And that was all about and that was like lighting, modeling, shading, you know, like
yep.
Working with compositing. Sonia Bouchard was my mate on that
mm-hmm.
on that particular show, and it was really hard. A lot of work for one person, but again, got a lot of experience. I was working with Gaku Tada and
yeah, you know, Gaku,
like,
yeah.
A great show too. I mean, you know, Chris, you know, like, were you in that show? No, you started on Day After Tomorrow, but just
tomorrow.
Right after that one,
yeah.
I guess. But yeah, again, it was great show to be in, a lot of learning. And all of the shows are always very, very hard. And you remember at the end when you're done with it, it's like, gosh, I feel like, you know, I could look back at it right now and feel like that was a great time.
Right.
Even though that it was, I remember it, you know, being a very, very difficult thing to do.
Yep.
Especially as you're growing as an artist and you're thrown into all of this work and responsibility. And I guess I didn't drown after that. So,
no.
You know, like we kept it up.
We did. I think there's one thing that I remember specifically that you sort of championed, and I don't know if you came up with the idea, but I certainly remember you being a big part of it, which has now become, honestly, something that's become very important to some extent or has have evolved, was the idea of shader compositing. Yeah. And you called it shampositing or shampoo.
Shampoo.
Yeah. And it was pretty cool because the idea here, I mean, let's get a little more technical, but the idea is that instead of having the final beauty render and just go with that and, you know, say best of luck to the compositor, what if you could break down everything that was going on in the shading of that object into different components, recomposite those elements, which is what the render does naturally, but mm-hmm. render them separately by recompositing them, but then see all the layers of the composite and then be able to adjust your shading and your in the comp itself, right?
Yeah, no, that was definitely an effort. You know, Chris Harvey,
yeah,
and myself were working on that for a long time. Chris Harvey was basically engineering a lot of the what, you know, how to tell RenderMan how to, you know, how to break all the elements.
He still works for Pixar at RenderMan.
No, he's done with that.
Okay.
I mean, he finished. He was up in Seattle working at RenderMan.
Right.
Developing software with them, and then he's now, I believe, down here.
Oh, really?
In the LA area, working for DreamWorks.
Okay.
He's a shader, you know, senior shading artist over there.
I should have him on. He'd be great.
Oh yeah, he'd be awesome.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan. So you know, we play around with that idea, and we put together the delegate all that stuff to the compositor, and you know, figure out because we needed all this flexibility. And at the time, there were no Uber shaders, right?
Right.
So, like that idea of having like, you know, here's a physically plausible shader that's been balanced and measured and responds to proper area lighting and
right.
all that stuff. None of that stuff was there. We were just working with not even a ray tracer,
no,
right?
It's
a scanline render.
Right.
So it was the poor man's version of that. You know, like right now you can do that with, you know, you push a button and all of the elements get produced to you when you need them, and you work in with a compositor. I need the spec pass independent of this. And, you know, like that's bread and butter right
But
now.
You know, honestly speaking, and I'll tell you this, and I think because I remember when you and Chris, you're right, Chris was a big part of it as well. You and Chris were doing that, and I saw the power. I didn't always agree with it because I always wanted like a pure shader, right, of some kind. But I saw the power of being able to do that and what that offered in a lot of situations. And I really came around to enjoying it. And then it was interesting actually for V-Ray itself. When I started to communicate that to Vlado and to those guys, this is a long time ago. And that's sort of what led them to be able to sort of do that, the same thing in V-Ray. That's like, okay, well, they started creating what they call render elements. And so all those render elements came from that influence of what we were doing back on Stealth was when we really did it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, no, we did it on iRobot, but it was a little bit different. On Stealth, we really sort of put it out there, right?
Really, really pushed it.
Yeah.
And I definitely took those learnings over to Pixar.
Yeah.
Because Pixar was all in camera, all the time, all a full-blown
right.
render.
If the highlight is wrong, we render the whole thing.
Exactly. And you know, and it took me about 10 years to get that established at Pixar. So,
10 years, wow.
Yeah, Pixar is a very, you know, it's an institution, right? And
right.
There's a lot of legacy and a hard place to change things if they are not align with their pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of have to make a little bit of room for that to be a thing. And, you know, and then with the advent of deep compositing, you know,
yeah.
we kind of pushed that to the next level where right. we are, you know, we were relying so heavily on deep comp and deep alphas and deep color and things like that for effects and lighting and
yeah.
Not relighting, but, you know, like, you know, massaging the image without having to re-render and all
right.
that stuff. Deep IDs.
Yep.
Versus, you know, like, you know, cryptomats, right?
Right.
So a lot of tech that got, you know, kind of came from that original idea, that seminal point.
Yeah.
But, you know, like it's gotten to a point where it's like it's everywhere. You know, everyone's using that.
Everyone's using it now. Yeah. But I remember that like that idea, you know, it was talking to you and Chris. But I actually even remember before that was Jonathan Eggstap too, when we were doing it for iRobot, because we kind of had the birth of that idea a little bit on that show.
Yeah, yeah. No, that show definitely kind of it was more we're using things that you don't traditionally use as a pass. You know, you're thinking, let's render all this abstract data so that we could take use of it in post and see what kind of effects we can get from that.
Right.
So it's basically, if you think about it, you know, like now with gray shading, you don't have to do that, but
sure.
Now you still could leverage some of that power, for other things, you know, especially re-rendering.
Yeah. You can do a lot now. Just like, don't worry, I'm fine.
Yeah.
You know, I can get it done, which is really kind of an eye-opening thing for me in terms of specifically the power of compositing. It was the time when I started to realize how much more I could do in lighting in Nuke instead of doing it, you know, in Maya and RenderMan or V-Ray or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, there's a distinct difference between VFX and animation. And,
sure.
And also there's a certain amount of discipline that is required when you're working in an animated film, because you really have to keep things super consistent from shot to shot. Versus that when you work on that shot that is in this sequence and it has a couple of effects in and around the shot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a discipline of like really nailing the lighting, like
in animation,
in camera, just like make it look good and, you know, like cheat in the comp.
Right.
Okay. So get your bones and, you know, like your structure and then make it feel like what it is. And then the stuff that doesn't work, you fix it in post.
Right. Yeah. post. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And your responsibility really on an effects like in Stealth or iRobot or whatever is like, you get it in the ballpark, but really what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to match the plate. Right. So you always have a reference of the plate to match to, but in animation,
there's no plate.
So yeah. you are the plate, which is a very different thing. So let's talk about that, because I remember you left DD right around Stealth or around that time, right?
Yeah.
And it was a big step. And I remember we were all very excited for you and proud for you to do that, because that was a really exciting thing for you to go there. So what led you to Pixar? How did that all happen?
You know, for the longest time, I've been a fan of the work that company was producing. You know, like every single film that they did was just so, you know, inspiring to me, you know, like from a storytelling standpoint, you know, like they were so solid. And you know, from look wise I felt like, oh, you know, we could totally do this, you know, like
sure.
It's so easy and this and that. And when I got there, I realized, you know, the tech that they had was very there's a lot of legacy, and to make a really beautiful image took a lot of work, and then I came to appreciate the talent that they had at Pixar, and you know, and how they could make the images that they were producing with the software that they had at the time.
Okay,
so to me that was like a little bit of like a shock, because you know, here is a company that, you know, is making the best possible animated films in the industry. And here are the tools that they're using.
That hadn't evolved in some
way. There was a lot of like, you know, like we've done it like this for a long time and it's worked out. We're going to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having third-party packages coming in was hard. But little by little, they started adopting a hybrid approach where they will let some, like, you know, we will have Houdini, we'll have, they used to have Shake, and then they dropped that and we'll bring Nuke, transition from TIFF to EXR.
Wow, yeah, okay, so a lot of that.
So it took a really long time.
Interesting.
You know, like the TIFF thing, the EXR thing was actually during Brave, right?
Seriously, so they didn't use EXR until Brave?
No, it's like 2012 or 13 or something.
And you were talking 16-bit TIFFs or?
16-bit TIFF. Or, yeah. So there's a lot of like things that change, but it was hard to kind of introduce a new file format into the pipeline.
Yeah.
Right? It's a big, big thing. You know, like,
well, I remember when we introduced EXRs, I believe it was on iRobot, right?
Yeah. I mean, we were working with that exponential RGBEA format, right. And then, you know, like EXR was kind of landing, and DDE immediately
we just embraced it. But the first thing that happened when we realized that is that we put all the layers into the EXR, and then we completely broke our file system because our files were way too big. But we were like, yeah, it's great. So, but I remember, yeah, it was a big thing, like embracing those EXRs back. This was 2003.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of jumping hoops and things like that. You know, it's like, oh, we need to call. So we only have 16 layers, 16 channels, right?
Oh, and that's right.
And then let's hijack that channel and call it channel blah, but we're going to put the normal spots in there, or, you know, doing a lot of that weird stuff. And then that went from 16 to 32, and then from 32 to 64, and then 1024.
Yeah.
And then unlimited at some point. But, you know, like as much as your file system can handle these days. But at the time, it was really, really tricky.
It was tricky, but it was cool. So it's interesting. So you dealt with a few hurdles at Pixar in terms of trying to update some of the ideas of modernizing some of the tool sets, right?
Yeah, I mean, like it was definitely a work in progress, and in a hybrid approach. Again, I appreciate the discipline that Pixar had, but at the time it was frustrating because knowing that there was something out there that could make your work so much easier, and somehow you couldn't take advantage of it's you know, it's hard to stomach and watch. And so
this is how I felt, by the way, on Day After Tomorrow when it dealt with ambient occlusion and when I could just do a freaking ray trace one and it would be done in minutes.
Right. No. And everyone's, it's, you know, it's just like economy of scale, and, you know, like it's hard to, you know, like shove in a new process into a established pipeline in the middle of a show, and or, you know, like it really takes a lot of consensus and, you know, changing minds and talking about around the industry. Not one guy is going to tell you how to do it, but you kind of have to see it from all different perspectives.
Sure.
And so that's what that was the part that took a little bit of time to do at Pixar. But eventually we got there, and, you know, like right now it's just, you know, it's working like a traditional shop out there.
Sure. Absolutely. So what were some of the things that you focused on besides, obviously, tools at Pixar? But you did some of the shorts. You did a lot of those things.
Oh, yeah. No, I've worked on, you know, I've been lucky to have worked on so many different shorts, you know, La Luna, Piper.
Right.
You know, Day and Night.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Lou, you know, like I worked on so many of them, and they're all so much fun to do because, you know, you don't get a lot of time. It's a small crew and you get to do a lot of things that are experimental. And, you know, hopefully if you're doing your job right, you get to bring some of the stuff back into production.
Right. Isn't that kind of the point of the shorts at Pixar?
Initially it was the point. And at some point it became like, we've done this before. You know, we've done that. There's nothing new to learn here.
But it was always like, oh, we're going to make a short to test out
subdivision
surfaces. That was Genji's game.
Jerry's game, right. Jerry's game was one of those things. But for example, Lou was the short that we used to like really push compositing. And use a lot of deep data.
Deep data. Okay.
The Good Dinosaur was also another show that benefited from that. Actually, there was these 20-minute episodic show, short or TV series made for TV for Toy Story. Toy Story, not of Terror, but the other one, The Time Forgot.
Okay.
And I worked on that, and in that short, on that 20-minute episodic thing, I was able to really push some tech and actually bring it to The Good Dinosaur.
Interesting.
And it was all about deep compositing and how can we use lighting and deep comp to do all kinds of like post operations that otherwise were really hard. Meant a re-render. So, and we definitely leveraged it really, really, really hard on Incredibles 2. I mean, Incredibles 2 was a show that we got to, like, you know, just the way we were working, we lost the year off the schedule.
Yeah.
And we had.
How did you lose the year? Was it just.
It was a decision made. Okay. You know, like, okay, can we get this film done by 2018 instead of 2019? And Brad was game for it. John was game for it. And So they talk to the crew, we're going to try and do this. And then we push back and say, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to have to do it this way. And that was the opportunity we had to kind of think this whole thing. We started thinking holistically, right? We started thinking about this sequence. We're not talking about the shot anymore. You know, like traditionally at Pixar, you look at every single shot and everyone has something to say and you get notes on that thing that is looping endlessly.
Right.
And everyone will find something wrong with it. So what we did was, you don't get to stop the shot. We're going to play the entire sequence cut with the editorials cut. We're going to get that open wheels on the screen and we're going to see it, watch it all together. If you see something, call it out. If you don't see it, we're done.
Wow.
So we were approving entire sequences at the time, you know, like we have faces and by the time we got to lighting was actually started with animation. So we pushed it all the way out to the front of the pipe, even with layout. We started making
just lighting it.
Yeah, right. Lighting it and working on that. And by the time we had the blocking animation blocking, Brad was already seeing
what the lighting is.
What the lighting was going to be. It wasn't finished, obviously, but it was like, you know, 70%. So we knew how much we needed to animate. We were like, oh, this is going to be really dark over here. We're not going to see much performance. Let's not worry too much about it.
Right. You
know, like, so a lot of the notes that we found, we went through our database and we found what is the highest number of notes that you get when you are in final productions of lighting.
Yeah.
And they mostly were intersections of geometry and or, you know, like animation notes.
Basically. Right, right,
you
yeah,
didn't
yeah.
see.
That you didn't see before.
Because you didn't have the lighting.
Right.
So now by front loading the lighting, you immediately saw those things. And we got to fix them before we got to that step.
Right.
So, you know, when we got to that phase, we, you know, like 50 shots, all done.
Nice.
In the day, boom, you know.
So basically you changed your review process.
Yes, yes, we did change it.
Were people happy with that, or were they frustrated, or they were like?
Well, there was like there were mixed opinions, right? Like,
okay,
you had different schools of thought over there, and what's ended up after that, it's a hybrid version of what Pixar used to be versus this, because this really upended the world as it were at Pixar. So it was hard. It was a hard change. So right now, I know that Toy Story 4 kind of, you know, grab whatever the Incredibles had done and really kind of polished it and made it super efficient. I know that their team ended up, you know, at least in lighting, like with weeks of just basically savings. And so that was really, really good. I believe Onward and Onward did not use that same approach. But Soul is kind of using a mix of that.
Interesting.
So, yeah, you know, very, very interesting approaches. Again, Pixar is great because you get to experiment on your show, but the other shows don't have to follow you if they don't feel like it's the right thing for them.
Right.
Right. So there's a little bit of that creative freedom.
Right.
Which, you know, it's good and bad, right? Like, okay.
Well, it's always a good thing. I mean, this is also a DD. Like, there's, you know, like, we learned some good things. Some things we're going to keep moving forward and some things we're not going to do forward, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because I remember the same thing when I was on Tron. They were like, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of things we did on Tron that were really good. We're going to keep that and we're going to use that on Real Steel. And suddenly Real Steel was, like, much more efficient, you know? And so those are things that make sense to look at that because they're all, that's kind of the point of the short, right? It's lower stakes of risk.
Right.
And then you can try new things and they're like, well, let's do that for the next one. Yeah.
A little bit of a control chaos situation for sure. You know, like when Pixar went to adopt Katana.
Oh, you
know,
wow.
Katana one of those things that we didn't want to drop into a show, you know, call out cold.
Right.
So we grabbed a short and did it with Katana, and
right.
that was the Blue Umbrella.
Yeah.
And it was really, really hard to get Katana to work within Pixar's pipeline. So
sure.
a lot of work had to be done before it could actually be somewhat workable for
production
for Dory, which Dory took it and did it. So Katana, we spent several years kind of getting Katana in embedded into the pipeline. And right now it's a super efficient tool and works great for what Pixar's trying to do, but it always takes a little bit of time to fold one of these, you know, like main packages into your pipeline, especially when it's handling an entire backend.
Right. Well, that makes sense for sure. So, but you are now back in LA. You're in this, right?
Yeah.
So you're back in LA. So what's going on with you now? So there's some new stuff that's happening in your career.
Yeah. So I pivoted a little bit and I'm now still working in animation,
right,
and trying to work at Morgan at this company called Skydance mm-hmm. Animation. And it's this David Ellison's company.
Right.
He just opened an animation arm. And so we're trying to basically come up with really amazing stories and content that you've never seen before. That's the goal. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, my position is more one of a global position,
okay,
where I'm working in LA, but I'm also working with our partners in Spain, which happen to be Alien Animation Studios.
Oh, yeah, Gonzalo.
Yeah, Gonzalo Rueda and crew.
Yeah.
So it's been a great opportunity for me and a great learning experience.
Yeah.
So you know, like, I'm very excited about what the future holds with our two companies. Right now we have a two picture deal, and we have been super busy at it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big undertaking to make one of these things, and you know, I've forgotten about how hard it is to start from scratch,
mm-hmm,
and how great it is as well.
Yeah.
There's no legacy. But at the same time, there are no tools. So
yeah,
a lot of stuff is being built right now.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out editorial.
It's funny now. I just remembered, like, you and I went to Spain together. We went to the Mundos Digitales.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where we ran into Gonzalo.
That's the first, you know, like, I think that was before they had started Alien, or were about to start.
About to start it. Yeah. So you and I were both invited by Paul Dubevic,
mm-hmm,
to do the talk there. You gave a talk on iRobot, and I gave a talk on. No, you.
I did a talk on, I think,
Day After Tomorrow, and I gave a talk on iRobot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and also Dan Lemon was there, and he gave a talk on Lord of the Rings and basically made us look like like, oh, my
shower,
God.
Yeah.
Have a shower. It was like, oh yeah. But yeah, we all were together part of that presentation with Paul Dubevic and Dan Lemon and you and I. But we met Gonzalo there, who was a really great guy. Really great guy.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, he's always great to, you know, like,
really funny too.
Yeah, super funny, super smart. So we're working together again, you know, like, so it's great to, you know, like, you know, see how he's at work and how the crew is over there. And
didn't they do what's that that animation about the astronaut that lands on an alien planet?
Planet 51,
right?
That was the one film that they did quite a few years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
And then Wonder Park. Was,
yeah,
another,
that's
one,
right,
that just came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I look at the work, great work.
Mm-hmm.
The stories are always a problem everywhere, right?
Sure.
Like, and so I'm always very appreciative of seeing the work first for myself. Just like, okay, that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was excellent. Or, it's all right, you know.
Right.
And admire that. And, you know, like, I respect all, you know, like, the people working there are so great. And so, you know, like, there's a lot of talent and there's a lot of, like, desire for doing great work,
mm-hmm,
you know, so people are hungry and into it. And that's very refreshing, you know, like, coming from LA and places like, you know, like the Bay Area, you know, after you've done like your fifth or sixth film, you know, you're a little, you know, cynical about the whole thing.
Sure.
And seeing people that are fresh and new and really into the work, it's always revitalizing,
right,
for me at least, you know.
So okay, so you mentioned Skydance and that you guys are going to be focusing on story and content that people hadn't seen before. So what is the kind of content that you guys are looking for in this animation?
Well, you know, like, it comes down to just, you know, telling really compelling stories and, you know, like, having really good original ideas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to me, like, the thing that I've seen right now, the focus that I'm witnessing the studio's trying to do. We're currently working on a short that is just really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so proud to be a part of it. And, you know, like, our features are also in the same caliber. You know, there's a lot of originality and fresh ideas and a true desire for making something very unique. You know, like I cannot really get into the nitty gritty of the stories, but all I can say is that they are very original with like really fresh characters, and we're trying really hard to not be either Pixar or Sony or Disney or DreamWorks. We're trying to find our own groove, and so we've been.
How has that been? It's been probably like interesting to find.
It's interesting. We're studying a lot of other films and other studios and what have become their thing, right, and their style. And you know, like there's a house style for Sony right now. There's a house style for Disney, and there's a house style, different house style for Pixar. We're trying to like not do that. You know, like but we're not falling into the traps of everyone's doing 2D looking films and let's put a twin shader on things and go like half 2D, 2.5D and 3D because it works so well for Spider-Man. Now we are trying to actually just do quite the opposite. We're like, okay, let's take advantage of what the renderer can do and see how much we can push that. Like, let's build a, palace full of glass and, refract everything and, put all this lighting complexity and, detail into things, while still making it feel not for real, but, design and
stylized
and stylized in a good way, so we're also thinking a lot about what our characters are going to be and how they're going to represent our audiences, right? Okay. So that's another focus. And we want to do it right. We don't want to like, we're going to change the color of the shader and now you're an Asian person and, this and that, right? It's more about like really, truly representing our audiences in our films in a way that is respectful and truthful and honest.
Okay. Well, you guys are pretty new company, right?
Yeah. We're just about a year and a half. And change or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's there are big ambitions and definitely a lot of growing pains, that comes from a startup.
Yeah. Right?
Like there's no infrastructure. There's a lot of things that we are kind of putting together as we go, but it's huge desire to making something great.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And you guys are going to be based in Los Angeles as well, right?
We currently are, yes. And we plan to remain in Los Angeles for the foreseeable future. Yeah.
Are you guys going to do production here or are you guys going to look at doing production? Well, you said Alien that's going to be like co-producing with you guys or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So ideally, we're doing a lot of the pre-production work over here in LA and some, previs and things like that. But the bulk of the work is going to be done in with our partners,
Okay. Well, that's interesting. What do you think is going to, like the world of animation is going to become is becoming important, I think now, there is going to be a lot of styles, right? Which is kind of refreshing. I think it's actually a good thing that, there was a time, when let's go back to when you first started at Pixar, everyone wanted to be Pixar. And so everyone was imitating Pixar, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The best example I see is like, when everyone's kind of trying to get that highlight on the eye, that little pinprick, little highlight that every other studio is trying to like, Pixar did it. And it was so good.
Right.
What I realized is that Pixar did it because they couldn't actually get true beautiful reflections on the eyes, and there was no path tracer to do that.
Right.
But if we had our way with it, we'd just let the entire world be reflected in there, and let it be natural.
Right.
It was an abstraction of that concept. Oh, that represents our reflection.
Right.
And everyone did that, and that became kind of the law, and like everyone's kind of like always matching to that. But to me, I think that was just basically a design choice, and we shouldn't be stuck with that.
Yep. Yeah. But there are a huge amounts of styles and there is room for a lot of styles and a lot of creativity right now.
I think it's great. It's great for the industry to have such an explosion of content right now. Like Netflix is one of those places that's pushing it, and all of our other, competitors out there are trying to find their stake in the ground. This is us, you know, like Sony's doing an interesting thing. And so it's Disney's got their own thing, you know, right. Pixar is also trying to run, you know, like it's very, very diverse. I mean, I'm liking that, you know, it's good. It's good for the industry. It's good for the people sure. working in the industry. And I'm very happy that there's a lot of opportunity for folks to still work in animation and, you know, have a way to express their creativity and sure. in a way that is not stuck to a particular style.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a good thing. And I think the world of the streaming world right now is basically also embracing a lot of diversity and creativity right mm-hmm. now, right? Because yeah. I think, you know, obviously my view is sometimes the cinematic world or the theatrical releases, they don't necessarily take risks as much, right? Because they can't afford it. They need to make sure that someone sees it. So like, don't worry, it's a Pixar film, or it looks like a Pixar film. It'll be fine. You'll like it, right? So they don't take risks. But the streaming world is like, we can try to see what it looks like. And that really opens up the diversity of the creative process.
Yeah, I mean, and also there's a different economics.
And
this is where things land. Like, this is where, you know, some interesting stuff could come out of. You know, not every single film could afford to be a Pixar film sure. or a Disney film because those budgets are just incredibly, I mean, so they're untouchable for the average studio, right?
Sure.
So the fact that Netflix is trying to get into the game, at least for the streaming service,
right.
and trying and keep the cost down, that means, you know, a different model of production, and that means outsourcing quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And you know, what does that do to the artists in town mm-hmm. versus the rest of the population? And it's, you know, like we're thinking like lighters and compositors and people like that. You know, that pool is shrinking a little bit locally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's more pre-production stuff. You know, so layout and camera and some vis dev artists and
right.
you know, sculptors and things like that. But modelers, final modelers and or you know, animators, lighting, compositing, all the back end, basically the shots departments,
right,
are overseas,
right.
So you know, like the only games in town to do that kind of work
are, is it overseas because of the people that are available or because of the cost?
It's straight up the cost,
right?
You know, like it's considerably a lot more money. We know it takes an army of people to get these films done,
right?
You know, like at the pace that we need folks here in LA to do that, you know, the cost will be sometimes double or triple, you
mm-hmm.
know. So it really kind of, like, economics kind of drive a little bit of that desire for doing it out there. But also what's interesting is that there has been a little bit of that. It's more democratic out there now. Like, people working in other countries are kind of hitting the mark closer and closer because of the tools I've gotten so much better.
Right.
And, you know, you get stuff to look really nice quicker, right?
Sure.
And so that kind of, the secret sauce that you used to have because you had all this in-house development
right.
is no longer a thing, you mm-hmm. know, for most studios. You still
And also the cost of the software has dropped.
Incredibly, yeah. So that also made it so that you could have some great talent coming from all over the world,
right?
You know, hitting the mark in a way that you haven't seen before. And so it makes it a little bit more palatable mm-hmm. to, like, okay, let's go and open a shop in, you know, France and
mm-hmm.
or, you know, London, or, you know, like, obviously London is a big game, right?
London is
like, you know, they've basically taken a lot of VFX work, and then obviously Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other places in the world that are now catching up to that. You know, like Spain is doing some interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller industry there, though. Like, it's not like as big as, say, you know, like some places in China are starting to pop up quite a bit. And,
yep.
You know, same thing with South Africa. And, you know,
interesting.
So it's
Australia.
Yeah, Australia, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting as well, but it's also in terms of the globalization of things right now. You know, another thing that's happened on the technology side has been, you know, the advent of cloud, you know, and cloud storage, everything else. So sharing resources has become way easier than it used to be, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that we are hoping to leverage more.
Right.
You know, like a cloud-based company versus a something that's a little bit more like brick and mortar, and we mm-hmm. have our
render farm and air conditioning
and the conditioning in the basement. So
right, yeah.
So that's changing. That's actually opening up a lot more opportunities to
absolutely
work. Yeah,
absolutely. The only real challenge, the one that I see all the time is time zones. That's the one that's can't help the Earth from being round. You know.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, we were living it right now.
Yeah,
and it's you know, communication to me still is the biggest problem, the biggest hurdle.
Right.
And you know, like being super clear about what you're trying to do is one of the things that takes a lot of time to kind of get right. So there's a lot of like back and forth that you have to do before you figure it out. And
right.
we're in the throes of that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I know I deal with it. You know, I work with Bulgaria all the time, and there's 10 hours difference between the two. So we pretty much only have like a 3 to 4 hour window to communicate unless I get up super early in the morning.
Right. I'm one of those early risers these days.
Yeah. Yep. My day starts when I take up my phone when I wake up. It's like, oh, you got 27 emails you have to deal with right now.
Yep.
So, nice. So yeah, that's a challenge there, but it is really nice that, you know, the infrastructure of the world in terms of cloud computing, et cetera. I mean, I can communicate. I had a 2 hour conversation with someone and it felt like they were in the next room, you know, and they were across the globe. So that's kind of an awesome thing.
Yeah, no, that's all those services are, you know, getting up there and,
right.
you know, like we use quite a few of them and they're considerably cheaper than they used to. Too,
oh yeah.
Right? You're not spending $250,000 in a VTC room,
yeah.
right? It's now there's the Zooms of the world,
right.
or Teams
yeah, yeah.
or Google and, you know, yep. there's all kinds of things and choices out there that make it a little bit more accessible as well.
Well, this is very interesting. So, okay. So you said you guys are working on a short. I know you can't tell me what it is or anything. And you guys are working on some features. You can't tell me what it is or anything, which is all normal. But can you give me a hint as to when we possibly may see something, a range of time?
So we're basically aiming to have our first feature landing in 22.
Oh, okay.
2022. And we still haven't decided what time that is, you know, if it's going to be in the beginning of the year or summer or whatever. We're still trying to figure it out.
Okay.
It's still a little bit of a, but that's a target at 22. And with that, we'll probably potentially wanting to have that short open up if the film.
Okay. And you guys are aiming for a theatrical experience?
Yeah, theatrical okay. release. And, you know, it's a traditional, you know, we'll have our legs of, you know, basically the liberals, right?
Right.
So.
Well, that's cool. And your role is mainly about being the liaison to your outsource partner.
Yeah, so I'm working with the head of the studio. I'm mm-hmm. working with all of the directors in-house, mm-hmm. and I work with our technology groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend a little bit of time and, you know, directing with the production designers, the look and feel of things.
Mm-hmm.
We still haven't gotten into, like, full lighting production, but that's my yeah. bread and butter.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that is so familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
That I will be helping direct. That being said, we have so many projects going on at the same time that I'm trying to build a group that could help us kind of manage all of the needs throughout the entire studio. So we'll be working here, working with that group, and then doing bouts of time in Spain when the time to finish the show becomes a reality.
Right.
So the last push, basically.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that sounds like there's going to be something to talk about again in a couple of years.
Hopefully, yeah.
That's cool. Well, I was really glad to find out. I think we ran into each other at SIGGRAPH, right? I think so, right?
Yeah.
So I was really glad to find out you were in town again and that we should talk. And I was like, oh, that's great. Because you were a very, very important person to me in my early days at Digital Domain because I learned a lot from you.
Oh, thanks.
And you were always very, very kind to me because I came from a different perspective about things. And so you listened to some of my ideas, but then you told me, okay, that's a good idea, but this is how we're doing it this way and this is why. And so I learned a lot about that thing, you know, and I learned, like I said, compositing was something that I remember very specifically learning about and why that was important, you know, because, you know, some guy who did ArcVis for a long time is like, why would you do that? So it was a really big learning experience in terms of, you know, feature film lighting, what that means, how to do that. And it was a lot of fun, man. It's a lot of fun. Well, cool, man. It's just been just almost an hour. So that went pretty quick, right?
Yeah, that was fun.
It was fun. Well, it's really cool. Hopefully, if you have some time, maybe we can grab some dinner after this and catch up some more, because I'm sure we have a lot of more stories to exchange.
Totally.
All right. Well, thank you, Estra, so much.
Thank you.